Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
Good afternoon and welcome to this hour of Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. Throughout this hour, we'll be talking with our guest, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, who is no stranger to this program. He is Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News, and he will be joining us to talk about all of the events that are happening in the church and in the world right now. We'll try to cover as many events as possible, but one of the things we will be covering is the reality of persecutions of Christians across the world. We cannot take for granted, especially here in the United States, that we have been tremendously blessed with an avenue of true freedom when it comes to religious expression. Now, granted, there is some level of societal persecution in the public sphere for the Christian faith, and there's some level of legal persecution as a result of that. Nonetheless, we still have constitutionally some of the best protections enshrined on a document when it comes to the expression of our faith, because to a man, every single one of the founding fathers believed in the right of the individual to profess their own faith. In fact, it was what led the vast majority of them to this new land. But secondly, to a man, all of them held the Judeo-Christian biblical principles that Judeo-Christianity has always handed down. Even if they didn't believe in them, they at the very least held the morality and the principles that were taught by the scriptures. So I want to draw that to your attention, that we'll be talking about these issues with Matthew, but don't forget that man is endowed with this reality of a dignity that is beyond ourselves. The dignity that we have is only in as much as we are bearers of the divine image. And so faith in God, who is objectively transcendent, beyond our material existence, is what actually gives our lives true infinite purpose, true infinite dignity, true heavenly calling and glory. This is our teleology. And the church, throughout her teaching, has always been committed to this reality. And so we fight for the primacy of the human person, even as we talk about these things with Matthew later. For now, let's take a look at the headlines.
Thank you, Marcus, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Thursday, May 23rd. It's the feast of St. Giovanni Battista Rossi. And today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. Pope Francis has recognized a miracle attributed to the intercession of Blessed Carlos Acutis, paving the way for him to become the first millennial saint. The miracle involves the healing of a 21-year-old girl who was near death after seriously injuring her head in a bicycle accident in 2022. Matthew Bunsen joins us with the details after the newscast. UCLA Chancellor Gene Block is heading to Washington, D.C. to be questioned about anti-Semitism on campus. On Thursday, the Republican-led House Committee on Education and the Workforce will want to know how a pro-Palestinian encampment was allowed to devolve into violence. The university has endured months of demonstrations and sometimes violent clashes between counter-protesters. Some of the lawmakers on the committee have telegraphed their line of questioning by suggesting Block has been derelict in his duty to protect Jewish students. Last week, Block survived a no-confidence vote by UCLA's Academic Senate. Some lawmakers want the Pentagon to rehire military service members who were fired for refusing the COVID-19 vaccine. The House Armed Services Committee Wednesday adopted the amendment to the annual defense policy bill, but it might not survive a meeting later this year in the Senate. And Al Cresta's hometown of New Haven, Connecticut, is declaring itself the pizza capital of the U.S. Over 100 New Haven area pizza makers visited the U.S. Capitol and listened as Connecticut Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro took to the House floor and claimed the city as the nation's pizza capital. Other members of the state congressional delegation participated in the event, with New Haven Mayor Justin Alicker also making the trip. From the AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Dan McGraw.
Good afternoon and welcome to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. My guest for this hour, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, a friend of the station and no stranger to all of you who are frequent listeners of this program. Dr. Matthew Bunsen is Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News. For the past 20 years, Dr. Bunsen has been active in the areas of Catholic social communications and education, and he is a prolific author. He's the author or co-author of over 50 books, including the Encyclopedia of Catholic History, the Pope Encyclopedia, We Have a Pope, Benedict XVI, and the Saints Encyclopedia, including the best-selling biographies of St. Damian of Molokai and St. Kateri Tekakwitha. Matthew, how are you doing?
I'm very well. How are you? It's always good to be with you.
Likewise. So we've got quite a lot to talk about, and I want to start on a very good note. Blessed Carlos Acutis, our first millennial potential saint.
This is very exciting news for the church, and especially for young people who have been drawn to him for a long time. It's remarkable that this canonization now is going to be approved, especially here we are on the cusp of the Jubilee year. Now, we don't know yet when exactly he'll be canonized, but I think it's possible, let's put it that way, that he might be declared a saint officially during the 2025 Jubilee year. I mean, some have already proposed the possibility, at least, it's up to Francis to decide when that will happen. In one of the small jubilees that are happening next year for teens and for young people. And that comes on the heels also of the expected canonization of Pier Giorgio Frassati, who is another saint for young people. So we're seeing, right at the time when young people need those great role models in saints, that we now have two of them. But I think Carlo Acutis has really struck the imagination of people all over the world. And let's not forget that this is a young man who died in 2006. So in what, less than 20 years, he has gone from his passing now to his likely canonization.
Which is what I was going to bring up. One of the contentions that you see, unfortunately, on social media, where everyone who opines is all of a sudden a doctor of theology or at least a doctor of canonical process. And so there's this complaint that the Vatican hurriedly rushed the process. This is not the proper traditional due process. And there seems even to be some kind of dislike, if you will, for ever since John Paul II's papacy, for this expedition of the canonization process. But if anything, the church now more than ever needs the great witnesses of those that cloud of witnesses that we need. The great testimonies of these people. So I see this as a tremendously good thing.
I do, too. And one comment that we can make, I go back to an obscure historical reference that upon the death of Pope St. Gregory I the Great, it seemed that the only real task that was given to his successor, aside from being Pope, of course, Pope Sabinian, was that the Romans wanted him to declare Gregory a saint, as hence we have Santo Subito, Gregory was a great saint, in exactly the same way that we saw the calls for John Paul II at his funeral in 2005. What did we see? Santo Subito, saint now, saint immediately. And it isn't that you're cutting corners or anything like that, but it's very clear that if you follow the process, and you just made a great point about suddenly everybody's an armchair theologian, an armchair canonist, and also an armchair expert in the causes of canonization, that the process, you can look very carefully, was followed for John Paul II, for Mother Teresa, and now for Carlo Acutis. And in fact, I would say that in Carlo Acutis' case, we're seeing the way that this process can play out in a very efficient way, but in a way that did not cut corners. I mean, we know, for example, that based on the decree that was officially approved, I think, just a couple of days ago, that Pope Francis has approved the miraculous healing of a young girl from Costa Rica. Her name is Valeria That's Valverde. Right. And she was near death from a bicycle accident while studying in Florence. And she had an emergency craniotomy, intracranial pressure, and that she could probably die at any moment. And yet, 6 days after the accident, her mother went on a pilgrimage to Assisi, prayed for the healing at the tomb, left a written note, and on that same day, Valeria began a remarkable recovery that
right.
we know that the Vatican's Dicastery for the Causes of Saints is very thorough. The causes are very thorough, especially when it comes to miracles of this type. You have to go through a series of close examinations by a medical board, mm-hmm. by medical experts, many of whom are not even Catholic, to determine whether or not this is a natural healing, whether or not this healing can be explained. And clearly, this was deemed a miracle. And I think we put too much sometimes in cynicism and less in actually listening to God's providence.
Right, and you're completely right about that, especially with the advent of new media that doesn't allow for... there was a point where whenever someone wanted to opine on anything, it had to go through gatekeepers who would, at the very least, filter the objectivity of the thought. Today, our cynicism, our sarcasm, our sometimes abject doubtfulness is put on display for the world to see, and you create these echo chambers. Now, I want to go back to this particular miracle. Contrary to medical prediction, she was predicted to most possibly die, and she wound up spending just a little over a week in the ICU, and she was sent home after.
That's right, yeah. And the really striking thing is that I believe it's called a temporal cortical contusion in her brain, which basically was a hemorrhagic right temporal cortical contusion, had completely mm-hmm. disappeared. And that is something that I'm not a medical expert, I won't even pretend to be, but those types of events are the ones that are studied, and they're especially scrutinized. And for a saint like this, a young saint like this, who has moved so rapidly to beatification and then now to canonization, those types of committees, that type of close scrutiny, I can guarantee, because I've had the privilege of being involved in a couple of causes for canonization, that scrutiny is very intense, precisely yeah. to avoid any appearance of impropriety, favoritism, or this idea that something is rushed.
Right. And the church has always been like this. I remember, as with most convert-revert types, when it comes to private revelations and apparitions, I tend to approach it with a certain level of healthy skepticism. But one of the things that won me over with the Lord's apparition was precisely this, the church's meticulous process in determining what was actually considered a miracle, a miraculous cure, versus inexplicable event. And so we've got this kind of junk drawer category, if you will, for inexplicable events. But to be properly qualified as a miracle, these very stringent guidelines needed to be checked and marked first.
That's right. And it, all we have to do is just look at the dating here. He died at the age of 15 in 2006. He was not actually beatified until, 2020. So we're talking about 14 years. So we have the 5 years that is the typical wait period for a cause to begin. Why? Because you want, in that process, to make certain that there isn't some kind of a rush into this process. And then you had the diocesan phase, you had it moved to Rome, and then the Declaration of Venerable, and then the beatification in Assisi in 2020. So we're still talking about 4 more years from the time of beatification, essentially, to the validation of a second miracle. And that, too, has to be looked at, that, again, this wasn't some rushed process.
Right. And that's crucial that we highlight that. I'm really glad that we bring that up. I'd like to just pivot our attention then to this conversation on due process. Pope Francis on 60 Minutes and his declaration about the female diaconate. That's about as clear a declaration as possible. And granted, you and I went back and forth, but you and Al went back and forth about fiducia supercans and a whole host of other issues. But it's wonderful with this kind of objective clarity, although 60 Minutes might not be the best platform to have done it, I suppose.
Well, but it's the one I think that Francis wanted. And I think any discussion of this interview has to be looked at within the wider construct, really, of what I argue is a very clear communication strategy on the part of Pope Francis. And you and I can talk more about that. Every pope has it. I'm not saying that Pope Francis is somehow devious or anything like that. Every pope has a different approach to how they want to communicate. And Pope Francis has chosen to make television interviews in particular, but access to secular media more broadly, one of the pillars of his outreach in terms of social communications, in terms of media. And so this interview, the first, as CBS rightly heralded, is the first sit-down with an American secular major network by a pope, certainly one of this length. And we know that, based on what they've said, CBS worked for years to try to get this.
Before I'd imagine so, yeah.
Exactly. But before we start thinking that this is somehow unprecedented, Pope Francis has given very similar interviews to secular major television networks in places like Brazil and Spain and Italy. And so it's not something that's just never happened before. Francis has chosen at this point, or decided at this point, to give an interview to an American television network, secular television network, because he wants his message to be given directly to the American public, but also he knows the American Catholic public. So he is very much shaping his message. But when you look at his interviews again in Brazil and Spain and Italy, the content is always very similar. And Pope Francis knows what he's doing here. And while it seems very off the cuff, he talks about the fact that he doesn't prepare for interviews. He doesn't like to have the questions ahead of time. You could see that he was ready for the questions that she was going to be asking, in part because he's shrewd enough to know what they would be asking. Mm-hmm. And his answers then are very specific, even if they seem somewhat casual or very earthy and vivid in its language. And that's why he was making a point here about women being ordained to holy orders in the diaconate, because that is a point he wanted to make very clearly. And it's hard to get more clear than simply replying no.
That's right. Well, thank you, Matthew. We're going to continue this conversation with our guest, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News, author or co-author of over 50 books. We're talking about recent news and events in the church and in the world. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter for Cresta in the Afternoon.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
God isn't content to love us from a distance. That's why he emptied himself, was born a man, walked among us, suffered, died, and rose again. That's why, having ascended to the Father, he gives us the sacraments, all so that we can experience his extravagant love through our senses. Being generously and appropriately affectionate with our kids is an important way to teach them about Christ's own embodied, extravagant love. There's nothing stingy or reserved about the way God loves his children, you and me, and we're called to love our children as demonstratively as he loves us. To discover more ways your family can celebrate the liturgy of domestic church life, check out the newest editions of Parenting with Grace and visit CatholicCounselors.com. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Father Benedict Rochelle.
There are legitimate differences of opinion in any religion. There are differences of opinion in Catholicism. But in Catholicism, you expect that people will take the teaching of its supreme authority seriously. To go diametrically opposed to those teachings is to not be a Catholic. Someone in the name of Catholicism is sponsoring the destruction of human life, lives of unborn children. And he got the name Catholic on the door. The highest authority in Catholicism and the encyclical Humanae Vitae, Evangelium Vitae, is absolutely clear that no Catholic can support abortion and that Catholics are responsible to take serious action against legalized abortion.
The people you know and trust are on EWTN.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
We are the pro-life generation, passionate about building the culture of life in our healthcare and in our nation. But not all healthcare options are equally pro-life, and some provide morally objectionable procedures. CMF Curo is different. CMF Curo is a pro-life Catholic healthcare ministry providing a pathway for its members to build the culture of life in their healthcare choices, not destroy it. Learn more about CMF Curo at MyCatholicHealthcare.com. That's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. Our guest, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, no stranger to this program, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News, and we're going over recent news and current events in the church right now. So, going back to the topic, Matthew, of Pope Francis, George Weigel made a brief comment about how Now he made this kind of off the cuff, and but I think he's right. He believes that the journalists missed the mark with the kind of questions that should have been prepared for the Holy Father. It really demonstrated a certain lack of an understanding of how, for example, Catholic theology is, or divine revelation. So even the question on female deaconesses shows that there's an ignorance of the commission that was started, the investigation, the findings of that commission. So, yeah, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I agree. I think this is not a malnourished enterprise, let's put it that way, when we're talking about a network that can spend hundreds of millions of dollars a year on its news product, on its content. And yet, I agree that the interview was very softball. Floated a series of rather unchallenging questions, I think is one of the ways that I put it in a piece I wrote. And that is that it betrayed two things, I think: a lack of real proper understanding of the church. But it was also a demonstration, I think, of certain biases that we find, especially in secular media, in particular in American secular media. And that is it's a perspective of certain assumptions. The assumption is that women should be ordained not just to the diaconate, but to the priesthood. And it is, for them, a cause to be championed. And it also betrays a misunderstanding that has been present throughout this pontificate, that somehow Pope Francis is secretly or openly plotting to change the teachings of the church. We've heard this now for a decade, and the misrepresentation of what he has said, I think, is important. So to that point, I think there has been this assumption, incorrect, as Pope Francis certainly demonstrated, that somehow he was going to open the door for the ordination of women to be diaconate and then to the priesthood. So her question then, framed as it was, and it's worth reading what she said. She said to him, "You'll have many young boys and girls who are going to come to Rome at the end of next month for World Children's Day." And she says, "I'm curious, for a little girl growing up Catholic today, will she ever have the opportunity to be a deacon and participate as a clergy member in the church?" And now, this has become one of the memes of the moment. Francis says, "No." And he just looks at her for a second and then says, "No." But then she went on by saying, "Is it something that you're open to?" And his reply, to my mind, was even more significant, where he says, "If it is deacons with holy orders, no." Now, he goes on to talk about the function of deaconesses without being deacons, that they've had great service to the church and that sort of thing. But he again clarifies, and he says, "Women are of great service as women, not as ministers, as ministers in this regard within the holy orders." And this is important to stress, too, that he has been consistent with this throughout his pontificate. He has used the phrase, "the door is closed." You know, he's not necessarily going to go on and quote great lashings from John Paul II, but he is certainly, or even Paul VI, but he is certainly clear in stipulating what is possible and what is not, and what the church can do and what the church cannot do.
Right, and it would be foolhardy to simply brand him as someone who is frivolous about the tradition that we've been handed down, and literally the objectivity of divine revelation. Because, like you said, when he uses hardline language like this, the media has a field day, because they want to see him as one who would subvert the teachings of the church from the get-go. So right. I want to pivot from there, Matthew, just to talk about another woman, Our Lady of Guadalupe. She took center stage during the presidential debate in Mexico. Now, that is not something I expected to happen. But I also want to say that's a debate I would much rather watch than upcoming debates that might not serve the best purpose for us.
I think you're talking about our upcoming election. That's a sentiment that has been expressed by a number of people, actually. In this case, though, you're right. Our Lady of Guadalupe, as we've reported, for example, at ASI Prensa and the Catholic News Agency, Our Lady of Guadalupe took center stage. And how beautifully appropriate is that in the presidential debate in Mexico, when two of the candidates had a memorable exchange? One of them, Xochitl Galvez, accused her opponent, Claudia Sheinbaum, of, quote, political opportunism. And why did she do that? Well, because Sheinbaum wore a skirt with the image of Our Lady of Guadalupe. Now, the point that Galvez was making is that Sheinbaum apparently very publicly has said that, as she put it, "You don't believe in God or in Our Lady."
Right.
And it was a remarkable exchange. Now, I think that Sheinbaum said basically that she was not even going to comment on the accusation because it's a provocation. But right. I think putting it out there is important because we do see, when it's expedient, the use of Catholic imagery by those who are not Catholics or those who actually hold Catholicism and Catholic teachings in contempt, and yet they will embrace certain images when it serves their purpose.
Right. And that's one of those things that we as Christians ought not to take for granted, that there really is a political expedience for the sake of people who have agendas to essentially want to get the Catholic vote, right? So when we talk about making prudential discernment, prudential judgment decisions when it comes to electing public officials, there's a morality at play here that's greater than someone just saying, "Well, I identify as this because I wear this, or I make the sign of the cross at a particular event in front of cameras."
That's right. This is something that the Church has taught for throughout her history. First we are called to participate in public life. We are called to be good citizens. If for no other reason, then we are called to do everything we can to promote and encourage and nourish the common good. And that means also bringing what we believe into the public square. We have a right to do that. We have a right to form our consciences, especially based on Catholic teaching, based on what we recognize certainly are universal norms of morality. And we also want to bring into the public discourse key elements of Catholic social teaching, because we are concerned about the dignity of the human person. And that's a point that Pope Francis made in the 60 Minutes interview, for example, about the dignity of migrants. Mm-hmm. Now, he readily acknowledged that it is up to a government to decide if this individual might be deported. He actually used that word, sent back. But he is reminding everyone that the innate dignity of the migrant has to be recognized, that these are human beings made in the image and likeness of God, and therefore entitled to those rights in that respect and the recognition of that dignity. So in exactly the same way, that's something that we also need to remind the public square, public discourse about that as well, at a time when we're seeing human dignity trampled in a multitude of different ways, from euthanasia and abortion, as Pope Francis says, surrogacy, which he wants banned globally, because it is such a grave violation of the dignity of the mother and the child.
Right. And honestly, his responses in this interview were, quite frankly, heartening for many people. The hardline approach he took to be as unambiguous as possible was crucial for the sake of cementing the Catholic Church's position on these moral issues. Now, continuing the conversation on the dignity of the human person, last week during the celebration of Pentecost Sunday in the southern Philippines, there was a grenade attack on a village chapel that the Islamic State took responsibility for. I spent 2 years in that part of the Philippines. I wasn't in Cotabato, I was in Cebu, but in the southern part of the Philippines, and the Islamic State had a very prominent presence there as well. And I think we can take for granted the sheer magnificent blessing that is our religious freedom here in the United States of America.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And, well, to hop back just briefly, one of the points that Francis makes about migration is that we are very focused, understandably, on the crisis in our southern border here in the United States. Mm-hmm. But Pope Francis also has the ability and the positioning to see this as a global phenomenon. And there are hundreds of millions of people on the move at any given moment because of a variety of different issues, causes, crises, emergencies, wars, and other things. And to that point, religious persecution of people all over the world. Christianity is now, as a number of reports prove, the most persecuted religion on the planet.
Right.
And this event, this tragedy, this vicious attack in the Philippines is a good example of how even in some of the seemingly far-flung corners of what we all think of as a thoroughly Catholic country like the Philippines, we have the presence of what are radical Islamic cells, whether it's Boko Haram in Africa, for example, or we have here various radical Islamic groups in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. This is a crisis for us around the world, and we have to keep our Christian brothers and sisters in our prayers. It's Catholics all over the place, all over the world, but we also are seeing the suffering and persecution of our Christian brothers and sisters. As Pope Francis likes to use the phrase, I know it's somewhat complicated theologically, but he uses the phrase, the ecumenism of blood, that the shedding of blood by Christians everywhere does bring us together in exactly the same way that the Christian communities in the early church were so powerfully unified by the shedding of blood, as Tertullian noted.
Right. And it isn't just in the Philippines that we're seeing this, particularly with the presence of Islamic states and particular Islamic extremist forces. In China, for example, we just this past week had the Bishop of Shanghai defend the Chinese government's religious freedom record, calling for the sinicization of the Catholic faith, which, for all intents and purposes, could stand juxtaposed to the faith. We'll continue this conversation with Dr. Matthew Bunsen on the other side of the break. Dr. Bunsen is Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News, and we're talking about current events as they pertain to the Catholic faith. Stay
tuned. I'm Marcus Peter for Cresta in the Afternoon.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu. This program brought to you in part by the town of Ave Maria, Florida.
Ave Maria, a big kind of small town. A golf cart friendly, ride your bike everywhere kind of town with something for everyone. Resort style amenities, two golf courses, shopping, and dining in our town center. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at the core of the community and a wide range of homes to meet your family's needs. Visitors are welcome. More information can be found at avemaria.com. Ave Maria, a big kind of small town.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
Learn and spread the word about the food, clothing, parenting classes, financial assistance that these resource centers provide moms, and not just for a few weeks after the baby is born, but often for up to 4 years after birth. Don't assume that just because you haven't heard about pro-life resources or efforts that they don't or aren't available, or that the church hasn't been involved. The media, and I know this firsthand from my years of experience, have been working with the abortion industry to suppress information about resources, as well as totally misrepresent or blatantly lie about what the pro-life community offers moms and families in need. And last but not least, do some homework and prayerfully give thanks to these pro-life warriors and consider becoming a pro-life warrior yourself.
Catholic Connections, Teresa Tomeo. Weekdays, 9 a.m. Eastern. On EWTN Radio.
What responsibility does social media bear in promoting the truth? The Catholic Catechism notes that in our modern society, the communications media plays a major role in societal information, cultural promotion, and formation. Since society has a right to information that is based on truth, justice, freedom, and solidarity, every segment of the communications culture bears a heavy responsibility for the common good. Media content within the bounds of justice and charity must be true and complete and communicated honestly and properly. The Catechism cautions us to be vigilant rather than passive consumers of information in order to resist unwholesome influences. Journalists are urged to respect the facts while still observing charity by not stooping to defamation of individuals. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. My guest, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News. We had just begun the conversation about religious freedom and Christian persecution in the world, and in particular, I had just brought up the news about the Bishop of Shanghai defending the Chinese government's religious freedom record at a Vatican conference this past Tuesday. So, Matthew, this problem of
Sinicization of the faith, or at least that's what the Chinese government is calling for, it could present a host of concerns as it pertains to the proper living out of the liturgical sacramental life of the Catholic faith.
And we have a very complicated situation in China, in part because of the Vatican-China agreement. I think it started in 2018. It has been renewed on a couple of occasions. And the point of that, as the Holy See has reiterated, was to try to normalize the appointment of bishops in China to end, if possible, the longstanding gulf that has existed among Chinese Catholics between what are the so-called underground Catholic Church and the Chinese Patriotic Catholic Church, which is government-controlled. Right. We can add into that as well the continuing process that you just touched on of Sinicization. Now, what does that mean? It means a deliberate policy under Chinese President Xi Jinping, really since he came to power in 2013, well over a decade ago, to take control of religions across China. And it isn't just Catholics, it isn't just Christians, but we're seeing an effort on the part of Chinese authorities to take control of all religions. We think in particular the Uyghurs, who have been subject to such horrendous treatment by the Chinese government. But what this means is that you are transforming, wherever they can, mm-hmm. the principles and teachings of the faith to be in alignment. What they describe as Sinicization, but what it really is Chinese communist doctrine.
That's right.
So it isn't simply, it's not a process of enculturation, which is something that the church has always been very good at. Now, without some controversy in a place like China, but the church has always looked to enculturate the faith because the faith is for everywhere. But this is a deliberate effort to transmute or to transform Catholic teaching, Christian religion, into a kind of homunculus of the Chinese state that represents the principles of Chinese communist parties.
Right. And therein lies the great issue here, because this effort at Sinicization isn't just something as simple as one would call enculturation, as you mentioned. It isn't even syncretism, which is this relativistic acknowledgement that all things considered, all things are equal. This is a calling for a reorientation of core tenets of particular religious professions for the sake of attesting to the fact that these things about the Chinese government deserve some level of superiority in the life of their citizens. And I mean, this flies in the face of, at the very least, the Christian doctrine. Shen Bin, for example, quotes that, render to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, to God what belongs to God. But talk about a verse being taken out of context.
Right. Well, and he is himself a somewhat controversial figure, and Bishop Joseph Shen Bin was sort of unilaterally appointed and then installed by the Beijing government as Bishop of Shanghai. Now, it was a clear, very public violation of the deal that we've just been talking about. And eventually there was some effort at normalization or recognition, but he's obviously in certain quarters a controversial figure. So it spoke volumes that he would be appointed in many ways to speak on behalf of the Chinese church at this gathering at the Pontifical Urbanianum, in other words, the Pontifical University in Rome, at this conference that was marking, of all things, the 100th anniversary of an important council that back 100 years ago was seeking to normalize and then to grow what was a then flourishing church in China. Now, we all know what happened in terms of the Japanese invasion and the takeover of China by the communists, especially under Mao Zedong, and then the immense suffering that followed. But he was there with a specific task clearly given to him by the Chinese government, and that was to speak and defend the record of China And as he put it, the development of the church in China has to follow a Chinese perspective. And what that looks like, I think we have an idea that was given by, I think it was the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, that there's no question that conditions for people of faith in China have deteriorated significantly in the last decade, and especially in the last few years, as part of this process of Sinicization. And what's at the heart of this is this idea, again, of a Marxist Chinese Communist Party interpretation of religion and faith. And that means also literally changing the way that scripture is written, doctrines are taught, basically to adhere rigidly to a Chinese Communist worldview. And that includes in some provinces. Now, we have to stipulate that persecutions vary at times significantly from one province to another in China. But there are certain provinces, for example, where children of the age of 18 are forbidden from entering a church. And the Ten Commandments have been rewritten more in line with the Mao's Little Red Book than the Mount Sinai's magnificent handing of the Decalogue.
Right. So I don't share this a lot, but I actually did go through, my entire elementary schooling was via a Chinese, kind of Taiwanese schooling system. Literally everything was taught in Mandarin. And one of the things that they had us do every day when classes began was we had to chant this Confucian philosophy, Confucianism. And a big part of it was adherence to the state, adherence to your legitimate authority. Back when this was written, it was for the emperor, right? The Kangxi emperor. But the reason why we were being taught this was because it was a big part of Chinese education, so to speak, this understanding that there really is a superiority of the state, and patriotism to the state is almost virtuous to the point of being a fault.
Right. And I think you raise a very interesting point, and that is how far we can go, for example, in embracing or that process of enculturation.
Right.
I recently talked with Cardinal William Goh of Singapore. You and I have talked about this, and he talks about the importance, for example, in traditional Chinese society of things like filial piety, of respect for parents and ancestors, that is a very Confucian concept, and how that actually does strike a chord with a lot of Christians and Catholics who also push for respect for parents and bridging the gap of the generations and understanding the value of the elderly. So that's one example, for example, where you can have very fruitful conversation, very fruitful dialogue. But when you are being forced, compelled on threat of arrest, torture, and execution to embrace Marxist ideology, that's something else entirely.
Right. Now, just to look at things that are happening closer to home, George Weigel levied some criticism against the Pontifical Academy for Life, claiming that it's betraying its founder. So what's going on over there?
Yeah, well, Weigel, of course, who is truly one of the world's leading experts on St. John Paul II. He's the author of the, now almost, I use the term loosely, but magisterial biography of John Paul II, has been expressing concern for a while about what he sees, at least, is what he refers to as the deconstruction of the Pontifical Academy for Life and the John Paul II Institutes for Study of Marriage and the Family. And certainly there have been a lot of changes at both of those institutions. And he makes the point of that for decades, both the Academy and the John Paul II Institute did what he describes as creative, innovative work in developing a Catholic moral theology and pastoral practice perfectly capable of meeting the challenges of the 21st century.
Right.
Focusing especially on the assaults on dignity and the sanctity of life. But now he's concerned that there is this wandering away from that commitment. And he cites the famous Jérôme Lejeune and John Paul II as models who perhaps are being forgotten in the wake of this kind of embrace of what he worries is a surrender to the zeitgeist.
Right. Well, this is something that we're going to have to keep following up on, because like you mentioned, he's been concerned about this for a while. This is not the first time that these concerns have been brought up. So we'll have to keep tracking to see where this goes, and I have no doubt that you and I will talk about this in the future. So to end on a happier note, archaeological discoveries in the Holy Land in terms of Christian pilgrimages.
Well, that's right. And one of the beauties of this is that we are constantly finding new excavations and new discoveries. And in this case, we're encouraging everyone, if you can, to do a pilgrimage. So what has been discovered? But the Israeli Antiquities Authority have discovered a Byzantine period church in the Negev Desert. And what does it show? It shows wall art with ships. And in that sense, these were likely painted by Christian pilgrims who had arrived by ship. And one of their first stops would have been this church as they went on to see other parts of the Holy Land as part of their own pilgrimages. So we're seeing in these excavations two interesting things. The first is the confirming what we've always taught, we've always understood, that Christians were making pilgrimages in early times of Christianity, that those who were coming into the faith wanted to go to the Holy Land, to go where Christ had born, had lived, had taught, had died, and had risen from the dead. Mm-hmm. But it also shows us that these Christians were so enthusiastic about what they were doing is that they wanted to leave some mark of their presence. And right. They left these beautiful marks, these what we see today are the remnants of these drawings on walls. And then it's also even a play on the idea of the Christian symbol of the ship, that we're also seeing real ships in which the pilgrims made their way to the Holy Land. So there's this great coming together of imagery, faith, and history in this one little excavation. And I think it's very exciting that an excavation like this can turn up so much.
Right. And not only is this heartening news, the uplifting news, this also just further serves to prove that a lot of the traditional practices that we have, and I mean that in lowercase t, including the making of pilgrimages, is something that can be traced all the way to the earliest of Christianity.
That's absolutely right. And pilgrimages have to be part of our lives. And whether it's far or near, make a pilgrimage.
Amen. Thank you, Matthew, for your time. My guest, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News. For the past 20 years, he has been active in the area of Catholic social communication. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter for Cresta in the Afternoon.
The Encounter Conference, June 26th through the 28th at the New Glass City Center in Toledo, Ohio. 15 powerful speakers.
It is the encounter with the Holy Spirit that makes Jesus come alive and gives us the courage and the wisdom to go forth and to even risk our own lives.
Everyone pretty much says the miracles that Jesus did are real. The miracles that the early church did are real.
As often as the popes are talking about the new evangelization, they're also saying we need to pray for a new Pentecost. We need to return to the upper room. Encounter represents the church returning to the upper room. As we're coming boldly before God and asking Him to renew that Pentecostal fire for the strength, the gifts, and the wisdom to be able to preach Jesus to a lost and broken world, so that we can become fully alive in Him, so that the world may come to believe that Jesus is the one whom God sent.
Register today at EncounterConference.org. That's EncounterConference.org.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
I come from the other side of the tracks, see? My uncle used to have slot machines. Put one nickel in and it emptied. Boom. And I brought him home in a bag, and my mother looked at me. Where did you get all that money? I said, I won them. You didn't win them. He fixed the machine. I didn't care if he fixed the machine or not, you know?
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
Welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon, finishing off this hour of today's program. We had intriguing conversations with Dr. Matthew Bunsen, and I want to draw a close to those conversations by reorienting our thoughts to the reality of the ontological dignity of the human person. Now, what I mean by that is our dignity isn't empirical. Our dignity isn't determined by what we can show on a piece of paper or on a microscope, under a microscope. Instead, our dignity comes from God. It is beyond the material, and therefore there's a real sense of absolute objectivity to it. So inasmuch as many of our brothers and sisters across the world are shedding blood for the sake of their faith, you and I are joined to them in this real ecumenism of blood. Their blood becomes the continual seed of the church. The blood of the martyrs continues to become the seed of the church. And you and I have an obligation to fight for this faith, to pray for it. Until next time, I'm Marcus Peter for Cresta in the Afternoon.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.